The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Hello there, welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of the best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so this week, comedian Jason Byrne joined me to chat about his latest children's book, The Accidental Adventures of Onion O'Brien, the Head of Ned Belly, and what it's like to be a professional worrier. I spoke to Alice Little, an Irish woman who has become one of the best paid sex workers in Nevada. And although the gripping TV series has presented them as dangerous yet somewhat noble, I spoke to Carl Chin, author of The Real Peaky Blinders, to find out who they really were. Ethna Shortall joined me live in studio to tell me about the complicated and difficult birth of her son Ruan and her new book, Three Little Things. At 9:22 now, this Monday morning, we are joined live by Mr. Jason Byrne. Good morning, Jason.
We're live. How are you?
We are. How are you doing?
I'm good, yeah. Thanks for having me in. I feel very privileged to be in the RTE. It's very good.
It is. It's always good to see you because you've a new book out, The Accidental Adventures of Onion O'Brien, which we'll get to in a moment. But it got me thinking because in the book there's so much school and childhood and messing.
Yeah.
I was wondering what was it like, not for you in school. What was it like to be the person beside you in school?
Oh yeah. Oh my God, that is a really good question because I hope to God he's listening.
Would you remember any of the heads you sat beside?
Yeah, I have. You see, the reason why I can write all these books and do all that stuff, I've got a great visual memory. So
have you?
I'm going to have to shout out to Ken Newman, right?
Yeah, okay. Ken, so we have a name. Ken is the man.
Ken is a beautiful man, and he was my best friends in school, and he sat beside me, and my sole task was to get him kicked out of his class. Yeah.
So get him laughing and
Yeah. So I was in my class, in maths class, and a lot of my mates would be listening in.
Yeah.
Like there's loads, like Barry Hennessy was another friend of mine and all. And we're sitting in the class and I would literally either like just do a little pinch on his leg.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And the maths teacher, he would literally flinch. And you go, and then I go, oh my God, Ken, what are you doing? Yeah. Ken, we're trying to learn here.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the teacher would look right at him.
You're trying to hang him.
And I'd go, out.
Out.
Like, out. And he was actually put outside the class.
And was there kind of a code whereby he couldn't rat you out because that's not the done thing? Like, if he gets caught and done, it's on his head.
Well, it kind of was, yeah. But I was so, you see, I was like a professional messer in school.
I'm
so
not
I
remotely
was, no,
surprised.
But listen, it was a good thing. It wasn't bad. I wasn't a bad child. I was a good child. The teachers were confused with me.
How? So?
They liked me.
Yeah.
So I was a nice kid. I did my work and I did everything all the stuff and I wasn't horrible to them. But I had something going on and I'd make them laugh and they didn't want to laugh. You know.
And even better.
Yeah.
There was a word we used when I was a kid. I don't even know if you're allowed to say it anymore. I'm just not sure. I'm not trying to be. But anyway, is hyper. Were you a hyper kid?
I don't know.
Did you ever?
Do you know what? I get asked quite a lot. Were you the class clown? There was at least 5 other professional clowns. I was way down the list. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like a mirror mate of mine, Barry Hennessy, who I'm going to mention now, actually did Michael Jackson dancing on the desk. That is no joke.
That's pretty high up there. Now,
this is when a teacher wasn't in the room.
Yes.
And he could actually do it. It was amazing.
There's a point in, like in your book is peppered with the top 5 lists. And one of them I loved was the teachers.
Yes.
Because I remember when particularly when my girls were younger, they'd make an observation. I saw Mr. or Miss whatever teacher in the shop go, as if they, like they were rock stars. Like they think they're like Justin Bieber going for,
You know, the whole point. Yeah, it's like you don't think teachers are human.
That's
it. I mean?
They're otherworldly.
How can they be mixing with other people out? You know what I mean? And that happens as well with doctors and stuff. Actually, my doctor says she could be in the shops and would be asked to diagnose an L1 at the in the cereal aisle.
I believe it.
Listen, now I know you're not working right now, but that thing there now is actually
is that a rash?
Yeah, she's gone with the surgeries down the road. No, I thought it'd save you time. And asking. So teachers are like that when you see them out and about.
The things pupils believe about teachers: one, they have no lives outside school.
Zero.
Two, they sleep in the school.
Yeah, they can't be out of the school.
Three, they have their friends over to the school at night. Four, they don't have friends. Actually, probably just other teachers who live in the school. And finally, they don't do poos or wees.
No.
So they, because it's impossible. You never see them doing that. Or going,
that's one of the lists in the book. That, yeah.
That, again, because you mind your school experiences. You do for these books anyway. You, yeah. you go back there to try and get a sense of...
I had great fun in school, though.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? So people always go, oh, I hated school. Couldn't wait to get out of there. But I had so many friends in school. I had so much stuff going on. I loved it. Do you know what I mean?
Did you find that changed dramatically between primary and secondary? Did it all go...
Yeah, well, what I would say about school, I mean, this is the great thing for any of the kids listening in now. I mean, they're in school, thank God.
Yeah, generally.
But anybody else. But the thing with me was, like, I was... It's hard to explain what... I mean, I had an amazing imagination as a kid in school. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was that kind of thing. So basically, if there was anything visual I had to learn, I could do that, right? So I could do history. That was good. Do you know what I mean?
Good.
I was really good at that. And bits of English. But I just thought, like, kids like me, like, we were shot down a little bit in school.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Now, this is in the 80s now, okay? So school's very different now. You know what I mean? But I felt like that... why do I have to know maths? You know what I mean? Why do I have to know these other subjects when that's not my brain? Do you know what I mean? Now, people go, oh, it's to get your brain thinking. That's how it works. You know, it exercises your brain.
Yes.
But like let's say in primary school, I was really good at maths because then there was like, you know, the train coming into the station, how many pockets has an apple got, all that kind of stuff and everything. And I could see it.
Yeah.
I could literally see it all in front of me. I mean, like... They were saying, actually, you had a guy in here called Ken Robinson. Do you remember him?
That's right, yes.
He says that, you know, that imagination is like the highest form of intelligence because, of course, you wouldn't be sitting there in front of that microphone unless somebody thought of it or those headphones or that suit or everything. And that's where it all starts.
Yeah, that's right.
So all kids in school have this mad imagination. I was even, my English teacher, we had to write out this essay in secondary school. I was about 14. And so he said, anything you want, just write everything you want. And I wrote about going on a date and I had a white suit and a medallion and a hairy chest. And he thought it was like, he says, this is disgraceful. And he made me stand up and read it in front of
everyone.
Yeah.
And it was he was trying to humiliate me and try
and bash down my imagination and go, no, no, no. But the class all laughed at it and they all loved it. And he felt, and so he went, you'll be nothing. I got all that.
Amazing.
So like to think that I've written three books,
yes.
Do you know what I mean? And because And I do what I do, my stand-up, you know what I mean? That's my imagination just flowing all the time.
And
you know?
And the school experience then for you was, I suppose, ultimately, you had that where your imagination was allowed to grow and evolve and so on.
But it wasn't nurtured, though.
That's the problem.
Yeah, it wasn't nurtured. And I think that sometimes that maybe that can happen still today.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, so my 19-year-old now, he's amazing. He's done his leaving cert. He did everything. And now he's heading off into art college and that's what he wants to do. Do you know what I mean? And that's where he's gone, thank God.
Yes.
But there's so many people listening now, adults, that are sitting in their jobs. And actually, the one thing that used to drive me mad was like I survived through the 80s and I got out where I wanted to go.
Yeah.
But there's so many kids that left school feeling stupid. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
Because they failed all these exams and because teachers went, oh, you're a tick.
And because the system didn't suit what you kind of described as their brains. You see, the system as it is won't suit everyone.
No, it's insane.
And very bright people don't get a leaving cert because it just wasn't for them. But if they were to do a different type of exam, they'd be getting A's.
Well, yeah, because that's the other thing that Ken was saying, that all our intelligence are like our fingerprints.
Yeah.
Every single person's intelligence is different. So it's not fair, isn't it not?
Yeah, that's it.
Do you know what I mean? I always thought like, and I remember being in maths and saying to the teacher, like, what is X plus Y and Z? Like, how can they add up? What are you talking about?
Yeah,
and, like,
yeah.
And she would just go, oh, just quiet burn.
Yes.
And then just keep doing it. I'm going, no, I don't get it again. Tell me in a more magical way.
You need the Sherlock mind palace that you can.
Like even when we were reading Wuthering Heights for our leaving cert.
It's a hard old book to read.
It's a hard old book,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And I didn't get it. And he says, can we do a play on this? I said to the teacher. He went, what do you mean a play? I went, well, we'd be brilliant if we were all like characters and we all had to act it out. But we had to read it out in class.
Yeah.
So nothing went in, you know?
It's a different,
and what a brilliant story is Wuthering Heights.
Precisely, and but as you say, it just doesn't suit. It doesn't suit everyone.
Well, one thing as well is that, like with kids and all. I mean, it's hard when I have my little kids. Is you watch your kids and see what they like.
Yeah.
As opposed to what society wants to put them into. You know what I mean?
Did you worry as a kid?
Yeah, yeah.
And were you, what were you worrying about? Was it everything or just...
Everything. I still do that now, though. You know what I mean? I'm a professional worrier. You know what I mean? They always say a worrier will solve a worrier and then replace a worry with it.
There always has to be something to worry about.
Yeah, I was worrying about getting in here in time. I got there in time, no problem. And then I was out there worrying, oh my God, I hope they don't forget me out here.
And does that come from being from when you were little?
I don't know.
Did you
yeah.
worry about school on Monday? Did you get the Sunday feeling?
I was just one of those. I mean, I remember my dad was a bit like that. You know, dad and mom. Like, I mean, they're in the '80s. I think in the '80s, worrying was a huge thing. Everybody just
worried.
A lot
to be worrying about.
They'd just be going, oh my God, I can't believe that's gone. I remember my dad getting a credit card bill. It was the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life. And I think it was for £17, right? And he went, oh my God, I can't believe, £17, what's on it? And it was fags and drink on it. So he got it and cut it up. And he went, that's enough of that. So there was always worry of that. And there was a worry of the phone bill, because you mean like the lock was on the phone. Do you know what I mean? Don't watch like that. That was another worry. There was constant like bills and money and worry and thing. And
so you got that gene then, the worry gene.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
And have you brought it into adulthood now? Are you a worrier now?
Yeah. I think I'm a worrier, yeah. But I'm okay. I'm not as bad as I was. Do you know what I mean? I used to always like fret all the time. But then I just think, you know, just realise that there's not a lot of... you can do about a lot of worry, you know?
Well, that's it, isn't it? It feels like such a wasted...
I remember good old Jerry Ryan here one of the times. Yeah. And he was talking, I love the way he used to talk to all the L ones, the poor women. He's gone, now listen to me, L ones. Right? Yeah. And oh God, you miss him, he was great.
That's for sure.
And he said, there's probably 10 things you're writing on your list this morning, right? And he goes, you're not going to get them done. Yeah. Forget it. You might get two, and well done if you get one, but you're not going to get 10 done. So he was
manage
great.
Your expectations.
Yes.
I was talking to Kevin Kilbane on the late on Friday night, and he was talking about how stuff was going on in his life and whatever. But he went to therapy. Would you go to therapy or would you try
it? Oh, yeah.
You do, or you did?
I do, yeah. It's great.
And do you find it useful?
Yeah, I find it very, especially if you're worrying and things, if you're stressed about life and what I do and everything. So that they'll just straighten out your head a little bit. I think everybody needs to do that. I mean, it's a big thing in Ireland where people go, oh, no, I'm not doing that, because they think that mental health, but a lot of people still do think that mental health is something wrong with it. It's like you can't let people in work know you have that or whatever, you know.
Seen as weakness, and there's a stigma still there, isn't there?
Yeah, but all you're doing, I mean, like, as they say, like, if your car's broken, you'll bring it to a garage. If your body's broken, you'll bring it to a doctor. But if your brain's broken, a lot of people won't.
It's so true. And, you know, you think oftentimes, you know, it's an old-fashioned thing to say, but it's a very American thing to be going to your therapist.
But well, we are very good at, like, just hiding things. Do you know what I mean? Bury it. Do you know what I mean? I often like to say, like, you know, in the 80s and all, your mother wasn't allowed to have a nervous breakdown. She had it at the sink.
She tucked to the bed.
Yeah, or she hung onto the sink and you didn't know what was going on. And then she was like, no, I'm grand now, that's great. Brush over it. But you have to, and you don't, and on the other thing as well is that you don't have to have something wrong or feel like you have something wrong in your head to go and try and make sure it's okay. Because a lot of people don't know they're depressed or they're run down and there's like stress on your brain from work and things, you know what I mean? So the whole mindfulness thing and meditation and exercise, and it's all brilliant.
And talking to an independent arbiter, like a therapist or counsellor, they don't know anything about you, they can't judge you. So that probably gives you a sort of...
like a free rein.
Free rein.
Yeah, it's great.
Off. Be curious to know. I'd like to be a fly in the... You know, just...
With me?
Yeah.
I'm not far off what I'm doing right now.
It's nothing. You just shoot the breeze.
Yeah, the breeze.
And do you feel slightly liberated when you leave the room?
Well, yeah. Well, just quick. First one I ever went to, because that's the one thing. The first day is brilliant. Because I remember going to one in Australia and you don't know what to do. Because I've never been to one. And I was very Irish. And I was going, oh, here, what's going on?
Yeah,
here
I don't need this.
And I'm a comic, so already you're ready to, like, you know, perform.
Yes.
You know, and they have to try and get in behind that. Do you know what I mean? But I went in and I said, look, I don't know what to do here. I don't know how this works. I don't know whatever. And she goes, yeah, well, you're already doing it.
Okay.
I said,
so that's good. That's pretty good.
You just talk. You know what I mean? Yeah. And it's great. And as I said, you don't have. I mean, I've never had depression. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
I don't have depression.
Good, but it's good to talk.
Yeah, it's good to go and get it, and just, like, you know, I get mental fatigue. I call it. I think.
Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it.
Yeah, so I just get exhausted from gigging and writing and working and everything, and somebody just, you know, it's like getting a massage in your brain.
Well put. What do you read? Do you like to read, generally speaking, do you read, what do you read, philosophy or history or novels?
Well, I'm in
or?
The middle of that Ken Robinson book. So
are you reading that?
Yeah, that's really good. There's another really good book called Shine. Everybody should get that.
Tell me about it.
Shine is, so it's a guy, what's his name now? I have to forget. We'll Google Shine anyway and try to get
we'll
the author's name.
3 seconds,
but it's
a
real positive outlook on life. It's a really good one, that one.
They're kind of, you don't want to dismiss it by saying self-help, not that there's anything necessarily wrong with self-help.
No, it's not even self-help, it just makes you laugh. It makes you laugh about how, basically what they do is, when you're reading those books, you're like kind of going, oh my God, that is so me. Oh my God, I can't believe that. Oh my God, he's bang on.
I love when you get one of those.
Yeah, you're just going, is this book about me? Hang on, you look at the back, it's like written by Jason Byrne. But like they do, they just kind of break it down. And then you just feel so, not silly, but you feel like, what is the point in sweating the small stuff?
It's back to your worrying thing then.
Just there's no point in sweating the small stuff.
It's so true. In your latest book, the Accidental Adventures of Onion O'Brien, you do something in it that I just love, which is the school tour. And the school tour to Oliver Plunkett's head.
Oh, right.
You know, that style of tour, I should say. Not quite the...
So what is it? Well, we went on a school tour. Yeah, because it was like the Battle of the Boyne out there and all that kind of stuff. And it was like Newgrange.
Yes.
And all that was all next.
Yeah, everyone was on the same tour.
What an area! Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And I remember going into the Oliver Plunkett thing with all the kids. And isn't it weird that the teachers, they're outside in the 80s having the fags, and they send the kids in with the guide. Go on in there. There's a head in there. We're like, what? And I remember we were only about 10. And I remember being a kid. I thought, is that maybe it's a dummy's head?
Yeah,
it can't be real.
No, it's the strangest looking thing.
Went in, and there he is, like in this poor little fella in the head. And if you look at Oliver Plunkett's head, he's wincing.
Yes,
he's actually wincing as he's been hung, drawn, quartered, whatever way he was. Yeah,
it didn't end well for him.
It didn't end well for him. No, I can't. No, I can't. I'd say if we put your head in there, just be smiling. It's a right.
I hope so. Because you alluded to Andy Cope.
Shine. That's it, Andy Cope, that's his name.
Rediscovering your energy.
He's a professor of happiness.
And did you rediscover your energy as a result? You didn't need to rediscover
your
energy.
No, I didn't need to. I just love reading all those books, you know.
Just a quick one on The Great Ape Escape, incidentally, from before, which was, again, goes back to your childhood.
But that's the first
exactly.
Book.
And in that one, you reference a previous attempt to...
Oh, yeah, okay, this is so The Great Ape Escape, that is about, like, an orangutan that the kids, the 5-0s, try to rescue from a circus.
Because,
it's not allowed to be there. So with that stems from a story when I was a kid. The circus used to come to the top of the road in Ballantyre. All different types of circuses. And we went backstage, we love sneaking around. In the 80s, it was great. Yeah. The sneaking and the checking out stuff and come on. And we'd be going, no, we can't go there. Come on. So we went backstage and there was cages with tigers and lions and everything. And
yeah, you're so exotic when you're a kid.
Yeah, but you could put your hand in there.
Yeah.
And a fella came around and went, lads. And we go, what, don't put, he'll rip your arm off, right? And first of all, I'm thinking, we shouldn't be allowed near the place. Yeah. And this is some guy going around with a stick, right? And he goes, that's a tiger and that's a lion. Don't, he'll rip your head off, right? And then he goes, he only ripped one of the lads' arms off last week, right? We're going, okay. He goes, here, come on, I'll show you the elephant, right? And we went, and I remember this, it's clear as day. And we went over to another tent, like a small tent, and we opened it up, and the elephant was there immediately. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
So there was no space for it. So its head was rubbing off the roof, sides. And I looked at the, I remember I said to him, oh my God, because it was a female elephant, and I can't remember her name, and she had a chain around her leg, and it was a stake in the ground.
Yeah.
And I said, can she not just pull that out? And just leg it. And he goes, yeah, of course she can. She's like, whatever ton, she's really strong, but she won't. And I went, why? He says, because when she's a baby, she's beaten every time she does that, right?
Okay.
So that's why they don't move, that's why they stay there.
Yeah.
So we got together after, like, he says, we got to get that elephant out of there. That's what we
and
said. Escape. The guy.
And so it's story.
We were nearly done. We were going, take the elephant out and hide it in Ballantyre.
Yeah. I can see where why you'd be writing kids' books with stories like that.
Yeah, I love adventures. I love stories. I love that. And my book as well. The kids, they use very little technology. They're always out and about, and they have to solve stuff among themselves.
Yeah, that's important to you. You're back into that famous 5E Secrets Avenue vibe, where obviously there were no phones, but you want to encourage that sense of get out.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it's like, because phones now solve a lot of problems for the kids. If they want to know something, they just go phone, answer. Yeah. This is them having to solve these problems themselves. You know what I mean? So this one is the head of Ned Belly, and it's like a treasure hunt. And the teacher who comes to the school, he's called suspicious. A Jackeen. He's suspicious.
Yeah.
He's wearing a kind of large fake suit thing. Yeah, with loads of air in it. And every time he walks... it goes phew, 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 like, you know what I mean? So there's loads of mystery around it, and it's just a good nostalgic book, and it's safe and it's beautiful, and kids from about seven or eight and upwards can read it,
which
is
great, because people ask oftentimes, you know, how do you get kids to read or encourage them to read?
Yeah.
But they need a book like this to
it's brilliant. I mean, you love reading as well. I mean, but I think it's just amazing to read, you know. And I love holding a book in my hand as well.
Yeah.
I
mean, listen.
I'm not the, you know, read it off the, what do you call those things again?
The Kindles.
Oh my God. I don't read it off the Kindle. I need the book in my hand.
I love the hard copy. And that's lovely hardback too, by the way, in the middle of it all. Here's a couple of texts. Jason Byrne, I'm sitting in a coffee shop about to go into my first session with the therapist. I'm feeling so anxious why I'm going in the first place. But listening to Jason has really relaxed me. The power of radio. Thank you both.
Oh my God. Well, they'll be fine going in there. And then what they'll find afterwards is that there is nothing to it.
Yeah.
It's nothing to it at all.
It's really a conversation or a chat.
It's like, that's all it is. It's just like, it's almost like a different type of friend that they're going to meet.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, with no baggage to be at you.
No.
Kathleen says, people go to gyms and never think it's odd. Going to a therapist is about minding your psyche. It makes complete sense. It's about separating body from mind. Everyone should do a little reflection on their inner life, which is what you do. Mm. Another says, I had a terrible experience in school. I spent most time out in the corridor, called all the kids by all kinds of names by the teachers. I was expelled at 15. I'm 48 now, self-employed, but I could never work in a so-called normal job. So tell Jason I love him and I painted his godmother Jackie's house.
Oh my God. Well, there you go.
Something good came of it. Jackie got a house painted.
Yeah, isn't that mad what he's saying, though, that he couldn't function in the school?
It just wasn't for him.
Shot. But I mean, of course, now, you know, the teachers are, you know, they're observing all kids with different types of disabilities. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally different.
Which is great. And look, we just need to just let them breathe.
You acknowledge your folks, Paddy and Ethna, but also Rachel and Ethna, your sisters, and your brother Eric. I asked you at the beginning of our interview, what's it like to sit beside you in school? What was it like to sit near you at the dinner table? I mean, were you the brat? Were you the crack? Were you, you know, what were you?
I was such an active kid. I was barely there. So it was like literally, this is a lovely image. This was in the first book ever written, which was The Wonky Eyed Boy.
Yes.
About me growing from the age of 5 to 15. There's an actual illustration of the mammies coming out to the end of the driveway with the cardigan around them. And I remember just sitting in the field, you know, and then your ma just going, Jason! And you're like, oh, God, right? And I remember Kieran Talon, another friend of mine off the road, we were in the field.
all the lads,
right, and the girls. And we was all sitting around there. And my ma went, Jason! And Kieran Talon went, shut up, ma! And I went, Kieran!
Trying to hang.
Then I went in, but right at the dinner table. This is the image of me at a dinner table. I'm coming in. I've got muck on my face, on my hands. Didn't even wash my hands.
Yeah.
Me trousers. There's actually a picture of me at the dinner table. My sister's birthday. The me trousers are wet up to my knees from just messing about in the field. And I'm sitting there, and I come in. Yeah, I'd eat. I just get the food into me as quick as I could.
Because you want to go out again.
I'm back out.
Did you watch The Muppet Show?
Mm.
Oh, thank God.
I love The Muppet
Show. Yeah, same here. Still do.
They used to have such famous people on it.
Like, yeah, and quite clever. It was kind of educational, but funny and a bit wicked.
Well, I mean, I took my favourite was the fairy tales.
Yes.
When Kermit the Frog used to turn up to when Humpty Dumpty fell off the wall.
Yeah,
and it's actually...
Well, I'm staring down to see the crime here.
He's all over the place. Yeah. So we don't know what to do. And he's interviewed by the king's horses.
Oh, that's great.
What are you going to do? Well, we're going to try and clean this up as soon as possible. It's so clever.
I'd like to echo, says the text, what Jason said. This topic is close to my heart. Just after booking a counsellor, after years of hiding so many issues that are now affecting me and my relationships and life. So thanks for that. Oh. You just pushed somebody in the right direction.
I know. It is brilliant the way Ireland is flipping around like that now.
Yeah, people are talking more and more.
Yeah, and I think that maybe the religion would have been another thing that would have pushed it down.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, sure. Marion says, I love Jason. He reminds me so much of my children's childhood. Everything applies. So it's still going. Another says, a very proud person. I'm a 65-year-old retired primary school teacher, and I'm always shocked when people say that a teacher told them they would be nothing. I swear I never knew anyone who said things like that to kids. The odd one was a bit indifferent or lazy, but not that mean. Jason is great, BTW.
Yeah, but that's only one teacher I'm talking about.
But that's precisely it.
Yeah.
But it's funny. It's a bit like criticism, which you might get. If you get, say, 10 reviews, people who are you know, up for review, they'll remember the number 9, which was cruel, and the other nine don't matter a damn.
Yeah, like Tim Minchin, who's an amazing guy. He wrote music for Matilda. Yeah. He's a comic.
Yeah.
I went to see him doing a show. He's a good friend of mine. And he said, I don't get affected by reviews. I never read them. And then he went into a whole song about a reviewer.
He
wrote a song about a reviewer.
We had him on the Late Late Show
once.
And we had to say to him, like, musically, I've got a song. It'll go on for 7 minutes. We had to say, well, actually, there's time constraints because we're live and it has to be about 3 minutes. And he said, how am I going to do a song? So he wrote a song going, how am I going to do this in 3 minutes? And he performed it. And it's on YouTube. And it's really funny clever. Yeah, yeah. I can see you guys getting on, actually.
Oh, yeah, yeah, he's a great guy.
And he came for a pint with us afterwards. And he was good company. I liked him. Mm. And his Matilda is just knockout.
Isn't it brilliant?
Yeah, yeah. Jason Byrne is a pleasure to listen to, says Margaret. He's so right about the school experience and creative people. Why is it that the teaching profession has such an insular view of students who do not achieve the high points? I hasten to add, not all of them, but very intelligent people never insult or make a student feel a failure. Good luck, Jason.
The other thing as well is that I feel that sometimes the teachers are focused on getting the kids getting good results.
Yes.
For the benefit of them.
To show that they have the marks.
Yeah,
I will
say I have experienced that with my sons in the past.
Okay.
The teacher went, we really need them to do well. It would be great if they did well in this. But it's for them.
Rather.
So they can show that they have successful students in their class.
To the detriment of the kid. Mm. Claire says, always enjoy Jason's very Irish humour, but how lovely and sincere he is to listen to this morning. Dare I say, inspiring.
Oh my God, thank you very
much. That's good news. Yes. I absolutely agree with this about the therapy. At 63, I have discovered this. And yes, I should have been going for the last 50 years, not just the last few months. Everyone should go and chat to someone once a month. You would have a pep in your step after every session. I love listening to this guy, which is good. Ryan, what happened to his friend that was outside the door at the time?
Ken Newman.
The time? How is Ken?
Ken's great, yeah.
They're concerned about Ken.
Ken is a beautiful man, actually. I remember he's a manager in the Ballantyre House, Ken.
Is he really?
He's going to get such, he's going to love this.
Imagine the next Friday going in for a pint. Well, no, hopefully not Friday, but Thursday maybe, or Saturday, going in for a pint and giving Ken the...
Yeah, he once rang me ages ago. This is a long ago. He goes, hey, Jason, will you tell this girl that I know you? And I went, hello? And she went, are you Jason Byrne? Yeah. And Ken goes, thanks, Jason. Hangs up. Like, that's a good friend.
He has your number. That's a good friend. Oh, you did a return. Listening to Jace reminds me of this quote. Einstein said, imagination is greater than intelligence, says Paul.
Yeah.
Which is quite nice. And I agree, says another, with everything Jason said, I always say laughter is the best medicine. And if you can't laugh at yourself, who can you laugh at? A lot of people can't laugh at themselves, which is sad. I wonder sometimes, is there a sort of a decline in humour among people? I find sometimes people are getting very earnest. And
do you mean it's the PC thing and they're being careful about what they say? Yeah, or
I'm not trying to have a go at the PC thing necessarily. I just think, broadly speaking, I find sometimes people aren't, their default is not to see the humour, it's to see the offence. And then they might come to the humour eventually after they're told A, where the joke is, and B, how funny it is.
Do you mean in a snide type way? Like, I mean, if somebody's saying something funny, you're going, it's not, I don't, not into that.
Yeah, I just wonder, there was
you
a
mean
time,
an offensive way?
Yeah, I think people are quick to take offence, I think, more than they used to be.
A lot of times, people will go and see comics, you know, so that the comic will say what they want to say, but they can't say it.
Yeah.
And
that's a good way, very, very interesting way of putting
Frankie
it.
Frankie Boyle is one of them.
Right.
So Frankie's vicious on
stage.
But nobody leaves that room.
Well, he knows his audience, obviously. But then,
but still, they sit there and they still will. I mean, there will be people going, "Oh my God, that was really vicious what he said there."
But I was talking to Dearing Gary on Friday night, and I was saying to her, because you're similar in the sense that you're always the right side of mean. I've never you don't do cruel comedy.
I mean, I'm on my British tour there. I just had people up on stage doing stuff, and I just always very careful at their. They're the stars.
I like that attitude. And I was just going to another thing, because you're in the UK a lot and you're touring. I always feel that the British are, while we're all friends, and I'm not trying, it's not having a pop of them, but they're very different people to us.
They can be.
I just feel the humour. That's right. Well,
I've studied the British for 20 years.
Well, tell
now.
Me about them.
Well, I'll tell you that Liverpool is very different than Manchester, and Manchester's very different.
Okay,
Newcastle,
well, that's a very good point.
Very different to London. They're all very different. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, so...
I was actually asking a questionnaire, what would you do if you were the mayor of London? I'd say I'd have an international hello day in London, because they just don't say hello to each other.
That's great. That is a great idea.
And I just go, and it has to just do, just how are you? I love doing that over there. It's the best fun when you go, how are you? And they just kind of stare at you, you know?
Good God, he said hello. Look at him.
Don't say hello to me. But I mean, I've just been in Scotland, and they are quite like us, you know, and the north of England and all.
Yeah, I can understand
that. They can be like us.
They probably,
you know?
Half of them are us.
I mean, one of my favourite gigs ever do was a place called the HMY Book Festival, which is basically they'd be there all day listening to Intellects. I mean, I always remember being in a room with Jon Snow, Christopher Hitchens, remember him?
Yeah, of course.
And Stephen Fry, the three of them were sitting in a room with me, and I was going off to do a gig just after them. And I was going, what are you doing, lads? And they said, oh, we're talking about blasphemy, right? And I said, oh my God, wait, you hear me? I got me blasting it out over there. And then Chris, and it was great. I mean, obviously Chris Fitchens is dead now. And he's the amazing man who tried to stop Mother Teresa having a sainthood. He was mad. He was brilliant. And he always talked about himself in third person.
A great tent to be in, though. With those lads.
Unbelievable.
JR says, good morning. I'm listening, really enjoying your interview with Jason Byrne. Love his openness and honesty. We'll add a few of the books he has recommended to my reading list. Oh. A very inspiring interview. Well, it's great that people are taking that from us on a Monday, on a Monday
morning.
I
mean, I've learned an awful lot from, because with the mental health stuff, I've got just deeper into it. And so as in like reading about it, meeting people, listening to, and I think the number one thing that helped me, which is, and this is really hard to ever get around Ireland because it's just not in our culture, is the meditation.
Yeah.
It's only, you can listen to somebody like Wim Hof or somebody who will be a guided meditation on your phone. You can take 4 minutes.
Is that what you do?
Five minutes.
4 minutes a day?
I could do like 10, 15. That's all. Yeah. And you literally get up and you go, oh my God, that's amazing. I even run as well. It's just a release of endorphins into your head.
Did that start after you hit a certain age doing all that?
Yeah,
like
I think
40
so.
Plus sort of thing.
Yeah, I think what it is, and that was my stand up. I think that we're all trying to fight off death. Can I also say as well? I'll just finish on a problem. I love this one.
Go on.
Is only as big as you make it.
I like that. I mean, I often say to somebody when I see someone faffing around, I said, "Look what they're doing to that molehill."
Well, I have a friend of mine who had a great phrase, and she said, "Look, there's no need to make a mountain out of molehair."
Well, it'd be some mountain though, wouldn't it? Jason Byrne, you're one of the good guys. I always love to
see
you in TV or radio. The book is called The Accidental Adventures of Onion O'Brien.
Yeah.
I mean, anyone who's been a child in Ireland will enjoy this book. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, and it's good to teach our children about the bits of past, even though it's set in the future.
But you can reflect on them on your own stories. It's illustrated by Oisín McGann too. It's useful to mention that. And you're going to a school event with Meath Libraries in the Solstice Theatre in Navan.
That's where I'm off to.
So tell them all we said hello.
And, yes, I will.
Yeah, good luck with everything you do.
Yeah, thanks.
Back to the UK.
Mind yourselves.
Mind yourselves.
Mind yourselves.
All right. Our guest this morning was born in Ireland. She left at the age of 5 and has had an intriguing life for the 24 years since she's been there. Her name is Alice Little and she's on the phone now. Good morning, Alice. Lovely to talk to you.
It's a pleasure to chat with you as well, and good morning.
Well, let us start at the beginning, shall we? And all roads, of course, leading to Dublin, Ireland, and where it all began for you. Give us a little sense of your Irish heritage, please.
Yes. So I was born in Ireland. My grandmother has property just outside of Dublin proper, kind of in the direction of Swords. Mm-hmm. Beautiful place with Connemara ponies, absolutely idealistic childhood, and it was just such a pleasure to grow up in such a surrealistic setting compared to, well, moving stateside and moving into New York City, which was very, very different.
A big, big change across the Atlantic and into the concrete jungle that is the wonderful city of New York. And tell us a little bit about why you left Dublin for New York.
Yes, my father was offered a job in finance, and so it only made sense for our family to go ahead and make the big move.
Okay, a big change. How did you adjust? I mean, you're only, I was going to say little, that's your name, but you're only young then. Tell us a bit about the culture change. Do you remember much of it?
Oh, God, yes. I was utterly petrified. I was so shy and quiet, quite to many people's surprise. I was bullied quite mercilessly in school for having an accent at the time, not that I have much of one to speak of these days after being stateside for so long. But I remember it just being so strange to me, the way that people spoke to each other, the way that they interacted with each other. I'd say the biggest difference would be in terms of respect for family and teachers. Mm. I could not get over how the American kids would just snap back like that.
Was that a healthier thing, do you think, looking back now? Or do you think it was poor manners?
A little bit of both. In some cases, it would be instances of children standing up for themselves. But in others, it just came down to a sheer lack of respect.
OK, well, look, let's get through the school years and out the other side, because you tried a number of careers that for different reasons, although in some occasions the same reason, you felt they weren't for you. You tried your hand at being an emergency medical technician, Alice. I think the one that I loved the most, given you've mentioned the Connemara ponies, is that you had a crack at the world, at the equine world, as a jockey.
I sure did, and absolutely loved it. I'm extremely petite. I'm only 4'8". And so it just seemed like such a natural career choice. But unfortunately, it just wasn't a great fit for me long term. So off I went, adventuring to try new things.
You mentioned a couple of times in the past that the likes of the emergency medical technician world and indeed the horse world for you on both occasions said they weren't a female friendly industry.
That is correct. In terms of the horse world, there is this frustration, I suppose, when it comes to female jockey, is that a lot of the male jockeys hold close to their heart. There's a hazing culture that exists where female jockeys are just relentlessly teased by the men, oftentimes even sabotaged either during or before the race. I remember one instance very clearly where somebody had ran off with my left stirrup literally 30 minutes before I was due at the gate. It was one of the most anxiety-inducing situations of my life.
Sure, sure. Well, I mean, obviously that wouldn't have happened in Ireland, where it's all peace in love and gender when it comes to the horse world, from my understanding of it anyway. But let me ask you a little bit about your decision then to move into another world altogether. You said that you wanted to work close to people, that you like closeness, you like intimacy. So where did that bring you to then, career-wise?
Well, I tried my hand at being an EMT, an emergency medical tech, and unfortunately I'm a bit too squeamish for that profession long term, and that eventually led to me discovering sex education. And what I found is that I'm incredibly passionate about sharing the information with people, so this way they're able to better their lives. And it was through that channel that eventually led me to my career here at the Moonlight Bunny Ranch in Carson City, Nevada.
So what is the Moonlight Bunny Ranch? Could you explain it to us geographically or architecturally before we go anywhere else?
Yes, the Moonlight Bunny Ranch is located in Carson City, Nevada, about 7 hours drive or 1 hour flight from Las Vegas, which most people know is kind of being the heart of the area. Well, the Bunny Ranch itself is a legal brothel. It's been in existence since 1972, in which it was legalized here within the state. Mm. Legal sex work is only operational in one out of the 50 states, and that so happens to be Nevada.
So how do you apply to get into the ranch, or how do you show credentials, Alice? How does that work?
It's actually an extensive process.
Sure.
People expect it to be quite quick, but really, it first starts with an online application in which you enter some information about yourself, your background, some general photos, followed by a phone interview in which they determine which location is going to be the best fit for your look, your personality, what you're wanting to bring to the table, if you're even a good fit for the industry at all. Again, we are very selective. Since it's only legal in one out of the 50 states, oftentimes we're on a wait list of applicants where women oftentimes are waiting weeks or months to get the opportunity. Fortunately, I had applied in November of 2015 and managed to get an opportunity to work there rather quickly. I was very surprised. I had the opportunity to travel out within 30 days of completing the online application process and then began the in-person process. You have to clear your medical check. All the ladies are required by law to undergo an STD or STI test every single week. And once that information comes back, you then take that over to the local sheriff's office, where you then undergo an extensive FBI fingerprint background check before receiving your valid work card.
Now, you would have been 25 years old, Alice, educated, smart, articulate. And I suppose some people would be wondering, of all the businesses in all the world, why this one? So that's what I'm going to put to you now.
Intimacy. It is one of the things that has become increasingly rare in our society. And frankly speaking, I believe it's resulting in severe damage and trauma to our society. If we look at the divorce rate, it's skyrocketing. We look at the depression rates, again, skyrocketing. The birth rate dropping. The younger generations are no longer engaging in casual sex like they once used to. And I think by and large, what all of that shows us is that we're no longer interfacing with each other in a genuine capacity. Social media, by and large, has created this falsified version of what we think is real and normal. And as a result, people are no longer reaching out and connecting skin to skin, face to face. I kind of wanted to be on the front lines fighting what is essentially a global epidemic of loneliness. We look at the suicide statistics in Japan, and it's just absolutely insane to me that we're seeing this trend worldwide, and yet we really aren't doing a whole lot about it.
And how about, you talked about wanting to be a sex educator, which is one thing. You can imagine somebody like that going, you're giving classes to couples or schools or parents and what have you. But it's quite another then to be a sex worker, as you say, at the front line. So how are you marrying the desire to evangelize about the need for more intimacy and skin on skin, as you say, versus the need to make a salary, a wage, by being an active sex worker at a legal brothel?
Oftentimes it looks like creating really unique personal experiences for my guests based off of what their needs, wants, and desires are. So, for example, let's take a guest that's in their mid-30s, male, who is a virgin. They've never been on a date before. They've never so much as kissed a girl. I'm oftentimes going to start off by taking them out to a local restaurant and showing them what a polite date looks like, giving them conversation ideas, kind of cueing them through that experience. So this way they master not just the communication skills, but also feel more confident in themselves. After that, we'll travel back to the ranch or to their hotel room, in which we engage in other types of education. For example, anatomy. A lot of men have no idea how the female body functions, and no one has ever made it safe and accessible for them to ask questions and learn about that. Certainly in this country, sex education is flawed and lacking. 13 out of the 50 states require sex education to be scientifically accurate, which means in the rest of this country, we can pretty much teach that the stork delivers babies as if that were a scientific fact.
Sure.
And that's the majority.
Yep. No, you're talking to a country that is based for so many decades on a Catholic education system, which required a lot of guesswork for lots of us when we were younger.
Oh, yeah. was just this afternoon on Twitter, I reached out and said, what were some of the sex lies that you were told growing up that you now know as an adult weren't true? And just the answers are quite astounding. Everything from, oh, you'll go blind if you engage in any sort of self-pleasure, to hand-holding will get you pregnant. Just the most wild things under the sun. And so naturally, we have a society, or really a global population now, that has no idea how to communicate in that genuine way. And I'm able to teach people one-on-one how to connect again, how to feel that genuine connection, really.
And if an individual or a couple come to see you and say, look, we're just frankly bored, where do you go with them, Alice?
You know, it looks like discovering why they're bored. It really all depends on the individual. There's no overlying advice. For example, is he always on top instead of her? Have you explored sex toy options? Have you thought about doing different types of sex acts that might bring different types of pleasure? Where are you at right now in your sex journey, and where do you two want to go? Sometimes that looks like engaging in a threesome in which I'm an active participant. Other times I'm more passive as a coach, where I'm showing him different maneuvers and positions that are going to suit them better. Other times it's couples that are aging, that are looking how to have intimacy in a way that doesn't kill their back and their hips, but still is really active and engaging.
Okay. It's all need. Right. So it's quite a spectrum. It's a menu in some regards.
Oh, very much so. It's very much so customized, tailored to suit you, your needs, your desires, your boundaries and limitations. And that's the one thing, too, is that I never push people past their comfort levels. It's all about creating a safe place for people to explore on their own terms.
There's a lot of people listening, Alice, and will be kind of surprised to hear you speaking so frankly and in such an articulate way about the world that we're discussing, because the image of a brothel, particularly, I suppose, illegal, but let's say even legal, is something kind of seedy for people, a little untoward and very otherworldly.
Yes. Most of the time when I ask people to describe a brothel to me, close your eyes and tell me the first image that comes to mind. Ooh, it's dark and it's smoky. Well, let me stop you right there, because our front entryway is this beautifully lit marble showcase that has featurettes of some of the various celebrities that have come to visit. It's very much so different than what people expect it to be. They mentally picture something along the lines of a seedy strip club mixed with a basement dungeon, when in all reality, it's kind of more like a luxury day spa meets really beautiful hotel suites.
And then the criticism will alight on you about men, particularly, exploiting you for money, how for years, particularly, men and women have fought for the rights to avoid that very thing happening. And it's 2019 and we're moving again into another gear change of what's acceptable, what's not. Do you reflect on that, Alice?
Oh, constantly. It's one of those things that, as a privileged legal sex worker, I have to confront the reality that internationally, there isn't a perfect system everywhere. In fact, many countries have systems that are exploitative and desperately need to be fixed. It's one of the reasons why I recently partnered with Prevent Human Trafficking, which is a nonprofit that raises funds for Thailand and helps to empower sex workers there to actually own the locations that they work at in a co-opt sense. Mm. Additionally, this nonprofit provides free education to the children of these female sex workers to prevent them from entering that system further, because at the end of the day, in Thailand especially, there still needs a lot of work, still needs a lot of improvement. And so I always look at things in the sense of, what can I do to reduce harm while also empowering women at the same time? And what that looks like is supporting women in their missions and their wants and desires. If the women of Thailand are saying, hey, we want to do this profession, but please help us own the location, well, that's the assistance they should be given. They shouldn't have their career stripped away simply because someone morally objects. It's their body, their choice, just like it's my body and my choice.
So for a session with you, as I say, with a couple or as an individual, can I ask you the cost of that?
So it is actually illegal to discuss specific rates outside of the brothel location. Mm. The closest generalities that I'm able to give are that experiences generally start in the four figures and kind of scale up from there, just depending on how long we are choosing to spend together and what kind of activities we want to engage in.
Okay. And your working week then, can you mention roughly how many hours a week you might work?
Oh, goodness. It completely depends. Though what I can say is that I generally only see one guest each day, and I try to only have 5 or 6 appointments each week. This way I'm able to really give somebody 100% all of my attention and focus. And outside of that, I'm also working on media content in terms of the Bunny Ranch podcast, my own YouTube series, and various other educational information to just help better people's lives and put that content out there to the world.
You mentioned your height earlier on. You said you're 4'8". Is that right?
Yes, that is correct.
Now, why are you smiling when I say that?
Well, I decided to go with the name Alice Little, partially as a pun, Alice being my actual middle name. Mm. When you have a super common first name, somebody goes by their middle name throughout school. And well, Little just seemed far too fitting to not enjoy the pun of it all.
And is it a pro or a con for you?
I think it's a pro. I think tiny is mighty, and people oftentimes take a look at me and are disarmed by the fact that I am so petite, which allows them to be more open-minded as to the message that I'm bringing forward. Whereas if I was a 6-foot-tall, imposing blonde bearing down for sex workers' rights, I feel like there might be a little bit more of a pushback as opposed to the little pixie-like 4'8" redhead.
Okay. You've described yourself, and this is a word that came to our attention again last week when we were talking about Mark Ronson, the music producer, who also described himself as a sapiosexual. Could you remind us what that is?
Yes, it means that I am attracted to the human mind, intelligence first and foremost, and especially self-awareness even more so than intelligence. That, for me, is my primary mode of sexual engagement, far more so than a specific gender or body type or skin color. I really don't discriminate based off of those characteristics. They're just not of any value or importance to me. The reality is that looks fade. We all change as we grow over time. And to say that somebody is less attractive or less valued as a human being because they've now moved from their 20s and 30s to their maybe 50s or 60s, it's ridiculous. It's really, I don't know, I just feel like it's so surface level that I couldn't imagine myself thinking in that term.
What would you say, Alice, to Irish people listening this morning who haven't had sex for a long time, who are having intimacy issues in their own relationships? What would you advise them? Would you counsel them?
Absolutely. And I really do believe it starts with a journey of self-love, reconnecting with your intimate self. Like, when's the last time you simply laid back and ran your hands up and down your arms or your shoulders and made notes of where is more sensitive, where are your erogenous zones? When's the last time you just treated yourself to an afternoon of things that bring you joy and happiness? And that's really a great launching pad for people who are looking to kind of begin this journey on their own. Start with the self before you start looking at your relationships with others. When you're content and happy in your own skin and you feel like a complete and whole person rather than one of a half, you really have the ability to enter relationships with a genuine capacity for giving.
You have the personality, it strikes me as being very sociable. Almost, I can hear your Irishness in that. Do you get home? I mean, obviously you were born here, but do you get home?
I do. I come back and forth probably once every other year. We do a gigantic, massive family reunion. As you mentioned earlier, Roman Irish Catholic is still very much so in existence throughout Ireland, and a good portion of my family is religious, and as such, they don't just have three or four children. They have like 7 to 10. So I have a lot of cousins.
And how does that go down in terms of your... So Alice, how's life at the office, you know?
It is very interesting, to say the least. When my family learned of my career and I kind of set everyone down and said, okay, I'm coming out of the, let's call it the arm war, since it's not really a closet here. It's like, hi, this is what I do now. And there was a very mixed reaction in terms of, oh my God, are you safe? Are you trafficked? Are you happy? Do you really want to be doing this? And it was just this opportunity for education, which ended up being really beautiful. And it kind of launched this wonderful discussion within my family in terms of, how do we handle sexuality as a species? Where do we fail the next generation? What can we be doing better? And I just thought it was so interesting to see everyone from my 21-year-old med student cousin to my aunt and uncle, which have been very, very much so in a committed relationship, having these conversations at the dinner table was really just amazing.
That's a conversation with a twist, Alice, no doubt about that. It's been lovely to talk to you, and thank you so much for your time this morning. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It has been such a pleasure.
Thank you.
If anybody has questions, I genuinely am an open book. I invite everyone and everyone to email me, contact me, reach out, whether it be questions, concerns, comments. I want to be a genuine resource for this very exotic and unique space that exists in Nevada.
Sounds good to me, Alice. Thank you so much for your time. All the best. I wish you the very best in everything you do.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much. Alice Little joining us from Nevada this morning. The text number 51551. 9:31 this Thursday morning, as a hugely popular, gripping television series, I have to say, I watched every episode, has presented them. The Peaky Blinders were brutal, and yet there was a kind of glamour to them. Flawed, yet charismatic, dangerous, yet somewhat noble, according to the TV show. And like the protagonists of many of the greatest TV dramas that we know, their story was born through history. But the question we're asking this morning, who were the real Peaky Blinders? And the man with all the answers is Professor Carl Chin, the author of Peaky Blinders, The Real Story, The True History of Birmingham's Most Notorious Gangs. Carl, good morning to you. Nice to talk to you.
Good morning, Ryan. Thank you for having me on your show.
You're a proper Birmingham soul, I think it has to be said. And your book is a pie-en in some ways to the past and to where you come from.
It is. I'm very proud to be a Brummie, but I must say I'm also very proud to be married to a Dub, my wife Kay, and may I say a happy 91st birthday to my father-in-law Mick Doyle in the English West.
Ah, congratulations. Well, now your Irish credentials with your Brummie credentials make you a very welcome guest, Carl.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so when you heard that they were going to do a show called Peaky Blinders, did you raise an eyebrow? Were you kind of curious in some way?
Yeah, it was very curious. The show itself has been superb for Birmingham, because who would have thought the Brummie accent could sound sexy? But with Cillian Murphy, it does.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's brought a lot of positive attention to Birmingham, Ryan, and that's been a boost to the city in terms of visitors coming here, and also in our national and indeed international profile. But like all drama series, there is a reality behind the drama, particularly with historical dramas. And it's important to bear in mind that the realities were not glamorous, they were not charismatic men, they were horrible, nasty and violent.
And not only that, but can you tell me, the Peaky Blinders TV show is based on the fact that these fellas came back from World War One, they were dispossessed, disrespected, and their anger was kind of born out of those two things. But you correct the record completely by saying the Peaky Blinders were dead and buried by the end of World War One.
Yeah, before the First World War, there was a number of English cities that had a major backstreet gang problem.
Yeah.
There were horrible men everywhere, few little gangs everywhere. But there was only Liverpool, Manchester and Salford, where the gangs were called Scuttlers, parts of London and Birmingham. And the gangs in Birmingham had emerged from the 1860s. They became known as sloggers, a term for somebody who strikes with a fierce blow. And from 1890, a new term comes in, Peaky Blinders. And that's the term that went into Birmingham folklore, and which is the one that has been used for the series. But the gangs were put down and they disappeared before the First World War. One of the reasons they disappeared, Ryan, was the strong policing enforced by a Protestant from Northern Ireland, a chief constable called Charles Horton Rafter. In the series, there is a Protestant from Northern Ireland, officer Campbell who comes over to put down the fictional Peaky Blinders.
Yeah, yeah.
But interestingly, whereas Campbell in the series is sectarian, Rafter, the Birmingham chief constable, was not. His deputy was a Catholic, Michael McManus, from the west of Ireland, from Mayo.
Yes.
And Irish policemen played a major role. About 10% of the Birmingham City police force was Irish in 1911, which was a much bigger proportion than the Irish in the general population.
Amazing. And again, it comes to, there are so many things that you kind of deconstruct, if you like. And one of them is the main point of the Peaky Blinders fashion, in some ways, the flat cap with the razor blades in the cap that they could slice someone's face with it in the course of an argument or a row. Again, completely baseless, in fact.
Yeah, it was a folklore. I'd heard of it growing up, as had many Brummies of my background and upbringing. I'm 63. And I'd heard this story that they slashed the front of the cap, the peak of the cap, across the forehead of their enemies, hence causing blood to pour into the eyes and blinding them. In the series, they say they slashed the peak of the cap into which has been sewn disposable safety razor blades across the eyes. There's a difficulty there because of the bridge of the nose. As it turns out, disposable safety razor blades in mass production form were not patented by King Gillette in America until 1904 and were not sold in great numbers in England till 1910, by which time the Peaky Blinder gangs had gone. Moreover, the first fashion of the Peaky Blinders was not a flat cap. It was what was called a billycock hat, and that was a form of bowler. And the name really was much more prosaic in its origins. It came about because the Peaky Blinders had short cropped hair, but they had a quiff of hair on one side, which they plastered on their forehead and which they liked to show off, Ryan. And so they pulled the billycock to one side, which overshadowed the eyes. And later on, when the flat cap came into popularity, they pulled the peak of the flat cap down over one eye, hence the peak was blinding, covering one eye.
Amazing. And that business of the bowler cap and the hair, as you're describing it so well, Carl, I'm thinking of the Clockwork Orange, actually. The Alex and his Drews. And that style. But style is such a part of the Peaky Blinders television programme versus the reality in the book, because you keep talking about, and rightly so, that they were unsavoury, unglamorous, and, as you say, unworthy of respect.
They are. And I think we have this kind of a distance from mafia-style gangsters, don't we? We seem to be drawn in by the Don, by the leader of a gang who looks after elderly people, who is kind to children, who respects women. In reality, these men are the opposite of those qualities. In fact, they don't have those qualities at all. The real Peaky Blinder gangs were backstreet thugs. They fought each other. They were street gangs. They fought against the next street or the next but one street. Some of them, however, after the ending of the gangs, went on to join a vicious gang of pickpockets that terrorised racegoers in the Midlands and the north of England and extorted protection money from racecourse bookmakers. That gang was called the Birmingham Gang. That was around in the 1920s, and it was led by the real Billy Kimber. In series one of the Peaky Blinders, he's portrayed as a London gangster. He actually was a Brummie from Hospital Street in the north part of Birmingham.
I mean, that was another discovery that blew my mind, because the TV show is it's so at odds with reality. Now, I must say, I did watch every episode. I loved it. But
yeah,
Billy Kimber was very London, very vicious, very hard, very unsavoury character. You have Alfie Solomon, played by Tom Hardy in the TV show. And again, he was the kind of the... Wasn't he the Jewish...?
Yeah, I interviewed the real Alfie Solomon's younger brother.
Did you?
Simeon Solomon in 1987. And Alfie Solomon, the real Alfie Solomon, was not an Orthodox Jew from the East End of London. Alfie Solomon was a secular Jew from Covent Garden. And he was a bookmaker originally. He got viciously beaten up by a member of the Birmingham gang in 1921, which led to a war on the racecourses down south. There's more racecourses in the southern part of England, Ryan. There's more money to be had there.
Yes.
And in 1920, the Birmingham gang, led by Billy Kimber, allied to two major London gangs, the Elephant Boys from South London, the Camden Town Mob from North London, took over the rackets down south. And that eventually led to a racecourse gang war in the spring and summer of 1921, which involved the real Alfie Solomon, but also the main leader was the real Darby Sabini. Now, you'll remember him from the series.
Yeah, that was Adrian Brody played him, yes, yeah.
And Darby Sabini in series 2 and 3 was shown as a mafia-style Don with an Italian accent. Mm. He was actually born in Clerkenwell in North London, in the Italian quarter of North London, but his mum, Liza Handley, was an English woman. And the real Darby Sabini always regarded himself as an Englishman with Italian heritage. His dad didn't come from Sicily. The Sabinis, we believe, came from the villages around Parma in northern Italy.
You describe Carl a Peaky Blinder, one man in particular. You call him a wife beater, a thief, a wastrel, a violent ruffian. Yeah. And his name was Edward Derrick.
Yeah, he was my great-grandfather.
That's quite the description.
Yeah, he was a man for whom I have nothing but contempt. I knew of him growing up. It was my dad's mother's father. I'd never met him. He died when I was 7 or 8. He'd moved away from Sparkbrook in Birmingham, where my dad's family come from. He moved away just after the First World War. And so we knew very little about him. But my great uncles on my dad's side, on my dad's father's side, they told me that he was a thief, that people told me, old people from my dad's street told me how he used to beat up my great-grandmother Ada, and that she was so afeard of him that if she heard him coming home drunk, she would run and hide in next door's house, old Mother Carey, who was beloved by all the street, and so he wouldn't go in there and touch her. So I knew about him growing up. I knew he was a criminal. I didn't realise until the last 15 years, when I've been doing more and more research, that he was a backstreet thug. And I've got a photo of him from the West Midlands Police Museum. The Birmingham City Police Force, yeah. Ryan, was one of the first in Britain to take photos of criminals.
The outstanding point in the series, and I'd love to know if this tallies with your experience in your research, Carl, is the strong women. And this would have been probably very conscious of where we are now in terms of 2017, 18, 19. But yeah. Really, back in reality, did that chime?
Two aspects there. First of all, women played a vital role in the communities of the poor, whether it was in Dublin, down by the Quays, whether it was in the back streets of Birmingham, Manchester or London or wherever. Mm. And my very first book was called They Worked All Their Lives. It's a social history of poorer women, and strong women were vital. And my book actually ends, Ryan, this Peaky Blinder book, with a tribute to the women. They are the mums, the grannies, the aunties, the big sisters. Those are the ones that are deserving of respect. However, if we're looking at the gangs, some women were associated with the Peaky Blinder gangs of Birmingham and with the Scuttlers of Manchester and Salford. They had their own fashion. They would have a long fringe at the front. When they were not at work, they'd have large hats, gaudy hats. But in terms of the real gangs of the 1920s, the Birmingham gang, the Sabinis, the Jewish gangs of London, women were not involved at all. And there is no evidence I've come across to say that any of the wives were involved in running the gang or being taking part in any activities of the gangs.
I was at the Dublin Tenement Museum earlier on in the week, Carl, and, you know, looking at two-bedroom...
Yeah,
not even flats, you couldn't call them that, but
no.
with 12 children, maybe 14. Yeah. And I was thinking about those mothers, one baby after another, yeah. on floor 5 or 4 in these houses, and the water was down the back, if not out the back, yeah. which was, and the toilet was cleared out once. I was trying to get my head around what they did and how they thrived or survived at all. I mean, you're a social historian. It's so important for you, from reading about you, that history, which is a big talking point in this country this week, because our Minister for Education has, in his wisdom, made history compulsory for younger people, which is tremendous news all around. But history has to be fair to all, and it has to be democratised.
It has to be democratised. It has to be inclusive. And the point is there, an important one that you've made, that the Peaky Blinder gangs, like the Animal Gang in Dublin later on, these gangs preyed... did not just fight each other, Ryan. They didn't just attack the police. They preyed upon their own.
Yeah.
They attacked the hard-working, respectable, decent poor. And it's really important that we bear in mind that the majority of poorer people were not criminals. That despite the deprivation, despite the trials and tribulations which beset them daily, they strove for the best and tried to create a better world. And the women, the stronger women, were at the heart of that struggle against an implacable enemy called poverty.
When you were watching the programme then, Carl, listening to your passion and your interest and your knowledge, did you find it kind of frustrating that they were being, if you like, Robin Hooded up versus a more visceral and cruel gang that they actually were in reality?
My wife Kay will tell you, never watch a drama, historical drama with a historian.
I can well believe it. Yeah.
And definitely do not watch a historical drama about the gangs of Birmingham with Carl Chin.
So how was it for you? Well, like, what peaky cap did you wear watching it? The historian or the TV viewer?
I was ambivalent. One half of me was saying, this is powerful, it's pugnacious, it's passionate, it's a compelling drama. The other side is going, the side of me is the historian going, that didn't happen. No, that's wrong, they should have done this. But it's hard to disengage the history from a drama, and you have to suspend reality to an extent. I think what is important, though, is that we need to understand the historical drama is that.
Yes.
It's drama, and it's mythologized. There's realities behind, and the realities are different.
Well, a text came in to say it's good to hear the truth about the criminals, who in real life are just unbelievably cruel and merciless. Programmes like Love, Hate, and Irish Drama here, an excellent drama, incidentally, and Peaky Blinders, are so detrimental to the human psyche, I believe, and especially, says this text, for vulnerable and impressionable people of all ages. It has an insidious and subliminal effect that gradually erodes our empathy and our sense of morality, and I cannot watch the violence and the manipulation and destruction of human life. And, you know, that is reflecting some members, well, they're hardly the audience of these programmes if they're not watching them, but a sense that there is a glamorisation, if you like, of whether it's Goodfellas, whether it's, you mentioned The Godfather, or whether it's Peaky Blinders, Love, Hate. How do you feel about that, Carl?
Again, it's this issue that it's drama. Yes, let's enjoy the drama if you can enjoy violence.
Yeah.
That is a major problem, isn't it? You know, the violence is key to all these programmes, and we can't enjoy violence. The drama itself, the story, is a powerful one, and they're all powerful stories, else they wouldn't grab our attention. But we must realise that real gangsters are not honourable men. Real gangsters are not charismatic.
Yeah.
They're vicious and they're vile.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what you give Peaky Blinder tours, is that right?
Yes, I do,
and
yes.
What is the most common question you get? What do they all want to know?
They all want to know about the razors in the Peak of the
really?
Cap.
Really? Yeah, that's the big one.
That's the big question. But what we're finding now, I mean, we get a lot of people coming over from Ireland. We're getting people from all over the world. Obviously, lots of people from Birmingham, the Black Country. And it's people do want to find out the reality.
Yeah.
And that's heartening, because one positive aspect of the series has been not only bringing people to Birmingham, but the other positive aspect, Ryan, is that it's engaged a lot of young people in wanting to find out more about history.
Yeah, that's a great thing. That's a yes. win for everybody. When you talk about your accent, like, I'm loving your accent today in a way that some people love the Irish accent, perhaps. But I spoke to a Brummie author here once, and I said to her, how's Cillian Murphy doing as Thomas Shelby accent-wise? And she said, it's flawless. She said, Arthur, on the other hand, is a bit wayward, let's say. Now, as a punter, I don't know enough about the accent other than to say it's intriguing. And actually, sometimes subtitles, I'll be honest with you, because they do a bit of sotto voce, but that's not their problem. So how do the accents fare? Because a lot of the actors in it are Irish. And far, you know, beyond Brummie.
It's very difficult for actors to take on the accents of the people of another place, because we don't hear working class speech that often on the TV.
Sure.
And so, particularly Birmingham is not featured. We've had, you know, series from Manchester and the Northwest. We've had elsewhere. But we've not really heard the Birmingham accents on the TV. I think the accents have improved as the series has gone on. It is very difficult because it's a city accent. We speak fast, and there's a movement up and down of the voice. Too many people, when they do the Brummie accent, go, oh, well, we don't want to come along, and, you know, we're boring, we're flat, and we speak slow.
Yeah.
We're not like that. But it is hard for any actor, I think, Ryan, you know, to for somebody to take on a real flat Dublin accent.
Yes.
You know, the Moore Street accent would be really hard to do when they used to talk, you know, selling the Cheeky Charlies and wonderful stuff down
the
in Moore
of the
Street.
The Cheeky Charlies, you know.
Yeah, do you remember?
Well, listen, unfortunately, yes, I do, Carl. Yes, I do. There's a great Irish presence in the community in Birmingham. I know Michael D. Higgins, our president, was over at the memorial to the victims of the Birmingham bombings, that desperate, desperate tragedy from 1974. Yep. And the families are still campaigning to get the Irish government to back a public inquiry into that incident. And, of course, you have a famine based, if I can call it that, population who made their mark on the city, which you've written about also. So a lot of Irish flowing through the veins of the streets of Birmingham.
There surely is. I was very honoured to give an address to the President of Ireland. And I have to say, Ryan, nobody from any major British political party has came and given support to the victims of the pub bombings. The Irish President did. And we're really grateful for that, because it wasn't only English lads and people, that girls that were killed in that bombing. Two Irish Brummies were killed as well. And it was an attack on our whole community, as all terrorist acts are attacks on all our communities, just like the gangsters were attacks on our communities.
That's for sure. I've really enjoyed talking to you, Carl, and congratulations on your book, Peaky Blinders, The Real Story, because you've got a great eye for detail and you tell it in the most accessible way, which is the best way to bring history to people in the street like myself. So thank you for your time this morning. I wish you the very, very best.
And thank you for having me on.
No, I hope we talk again sometime. All the best.
I'd very much like to. Goodbye.
Likewise. Bye-bye. Okay, but that's Professor Carl Chin. He's very, very, he's lovely, isn't he? A lovely, entertaining speaker and articulate look into the real world of the Peaky Blinders. That's the book. It's called Peaky Blinders, The Real Story. 9:26 this Friday morning, and we have in studio Ethna Shortall. Good morning, Ethna. Nice to see you again.
Good morning, Ryan. Thank you.
Your third novel is called Three Little Truths. I mean, the books have taken off. We'll talk about that in a second. But, you know, we would have known you down through the years as a journalist, hacking away like all good journalists do. But the books have brought you to a new place altogether. It strikes me as though you're living the novelist's dream.
Well, is anyone ever living the novelist's dream? At the moment, it feels like, yes, it's very good. I mean, when I started writing this book, my third book, I was writing a different story and it didn't work out. And I spent months writing it and only to scrap it after, I think, 7 months. So that didn't feel like the dream. But now that I wrote a book I wanted to write and it's done well, like, and it's doing well, the reviews are good, it's, you know, it's having its success as it comes out. And I feel like the others continue to do well as well, the first two.
It's a good news story, isn't it? All things told. But even better news is the little man outside who I had the
Ruin.
Pleasure. So tell me about him. Thank you for letting me hold him.
Well, I wanted to get a photo because I was thinking when he goes to school, I was saying you need to still be presenting the toy show so that he can say to his friends, oh, look, when I was only 6 weeks old, I met the presenter of the toy show. So there. He's great. He's only 6 weeks. His arrival was pretty dramatic. He had issues in the womb. He had stopped putting on weight. He was very small. He was full term, but he was still only 5 pounds 11. And it was a proper emergency delivery, C-section. And I was just in for routine checkup, and his heart rate just plummeted, and so they had to take him out there.
What's that like when you're hearing this news through, you know, masks and scrubs?
It was awful. I still sort of get my head around this, but I say that the day he was born was the worst day of my life, because I don't really associate with him. I didn't see him until the next day. He was taken to intensive care straight away, and it feels like the experience of him being taken out of me, which is what it felt like, not really birth, is entirely separate from him. You know, I think they're two separate incidences. I kind of wish his birthday was the next day or something.
Do you really? And I mean, because it sounds, as you're describing it, that it was not chaotic, but it was traumatic.
Thought I was going to my mum's house that evening to have a curry she had made at 7 o'clock, and I was not. I was having a baby. Like, his dad missed, Ruin's dad missed the birth, which is terrible for him. I mean, I feel like I missed it. So the whole thing was, it just happened so quickly. I mean, it was brilliant and it had to happen. And I'm so grateful to the staff at the Rotunda for getting him out. And I just, there, I, I want to give them everything. They were amazing. But yeah, it was very tough. And he was in intensive care for a few days. But he's doing great. Like, he's thriving, as they say. He's put on loads of weight and they're not worried about him anymore.
I'm just struck, as a wordsmith like yourself, that you choose your words carefully. And to say, as you said twice, getting him out.
Yeah.
It's
Well, it didn't feel like a birth, you know, because it was look, people have different kinds of C-sections and there are different kinds of emergency C-sections, and I just didn't know it was coming. Like, I went into shock as soon as they said, we have to get him out now, and ran me through the hospital. It was, you know, like something from the movies. And I was shaking, you know. They found it hard to get the spinal anaesthetic in because I was shaking so much. And I wasn't thinking there'll be a baby at the end of this, as you often are when you go through birth, of, you know, and you think, okay, I'm going to get a baby. I sort of forgot about that because it happened so suddenly. And like I said, I didn't see him until the next morning. So, and then he was covered in tubes and he was absolutely tiny, and, you know, so it's kind of upsetting. But I'm getting better at talking about this, and I still haven't processed it fully, I don't think.
It was only a few weeks ago.
Yeah, exactly. But because he's so great, I almost feel guilty talking about it being bad at the beginning, because it's so good now, you know. He's so good.
I appreciate that, but aren't you entitled to reflect on what was a difficult time without having to apologise for feeling a certain way?
Yeah, I am, and that's maybe what I'm coming to terms with, and I hope to write about it one day when I get my head together properly. And when there's a proper emergency like that, you go back to the hospital, I'm going back in a couple of weeks, and you talk with consultants and senior people about what happened and why it happened and things like that. So that's great, and I think that process will help as well.
When the dust settles. Yeah. Because what you produced to me this morning, when you put your little boy in my arms, was a trouble-free, you know, I got the easy bit.
A
trouble-free, healthy, bouncing.
Yeah. You know, and he sleeps and he feeds. So, I mean, what more could you want from a six-week-old, you know?
Yeah,
so,
but it's a difficult time, Ethna. I mean, let's not, you know, talk about anything other than that. It was difficult. But like you say, you're through the storm, I think, in some ways. And as you say, that'll inform you, because your books are very much informed on things that have happened down through the years in your life.
Yes, I keep taking things from real life, and not always to the delight of people around me. But
well, yeah, I mean, I remember when we spoke the last time, you talked about the difficulty in finding a house and buying a house and all the rest of it. Which you ultimately
did. Yes, which we did, yeah.
And, you know, you talk about in your new book, which I think has this very, a lot of resonance with what people are doing. I think they'll really tune into it. For example, when you move into a new road, and it's like, I always say we're adults are children with wrinkles, and it's like being a kid going to a new school. And tell me about the phenomenon that's very much not part of our parents' generation, but part of ours, of the WhatsApp neighbourhood. This is a thing. For those who aren't in one, tell us what it is.
Yeah, so Three Little Treats is it's about three new neighbours that move into a road. They've all moved in within the past year to this road called Pine Road.
Sure.
But the story is framed, every few chapters is framed by WhatsApp correspondence between the women on the road have their own WhatsApp group. It was ostensibly set up to organise their monthly poker games, but really it's about the gossip and the goings-on. And they're talking in the book, they're talking about, like, you know, the normal neighbourly concerns, like they think there's a suspected rat infestation in the gardens, and who has a rat hole in their garden? Someone gets the Irish Times delivered every day, the paper's being stolen, and then parking. Now, anyone in Dublin knows that parking is an obsession, and like the road I grew up on, parking was a bit of an obsession. The road I now live on, parking is an obsession. And it's in the book, this is what they're talking about in WhatsApp, but mainly they're talking about the new neighbours that have moved in and why have they moved in and what's going on, particularly one woman, Martha, moved in with her family overnight, very mysterious circumstances. But originally my idea for the WhatsApp group came from my mom, the road I grew up on, my mom and the women on the road, they have a WhatsApp group that is set up for poker and is about other things. Now, I have to say that the real women on the road I grew up on, if they're listening, are not in this book, and they're much nicer than these characters. I had to make them a little nastier and you know, just a little more mischievous to make it fun for fiction. But like, the phenomenon of the WhatsApp group is real, I think, is in any neighbourhood. Like, we moved into our new house and we joined the Residents Association, and now I didn't join the WhatsApp group because I really don't like the constant pinging, but I got my boyfriend to join, and so he's in it. And again, parking is this, you know, regular obsession, and like, it's just a way for all the neighbours to keep an eye on everyone else. And I just thought, what a brilliant way to frame a story, you know, to give
perfect.
You a taste of what's going on. And then beyond the WhatsApp group, we go into what actually happens.
Well, look, let's give your mum a shout out because she has told you to stop staying. That it's based roughly on the road you grow. So look,
she made me change the name. Originally, I called it the name of my road, and she was like, "No, I still have to live here. You've changed that name."
I have to say, I'm with your mum on this one, and you know, she'll make me a curry for this. I hope.
Yeah.
Which we'll get to. But anyway, we'll give her the break on that. But the WhatsApp phenomenon, to me, in some ways, I always refer to the tyranny of the ticks because. You talk about pinging. It's the ticking because I have the sound muted on the phone. But the ticking, where the blue tick, the clear tick, did it deliver? Did you answer? Why aren't you answering?
And you know, I know that you saw it. So why haven't you written back?
So now you're developing an ulcer. And then you have the idea of the WhatsApp group. Then what do we all now have to respond to that thing or that someone just said? Or if you don't, are you aloof? You know, there's a whole psychology.
I do that as well. You have that. Well, someone like in the book, you know. Well, I said this on. The message group, but someone didn't write back, so this must mean that, you know, they hate me or whatever. It might be like, I mean, you can read so much into it.
I'd like to ask you about a difficult experience that you had on the late bus from Belfast to Dublin. It was a summer night, coming up to midnight, very late, and you were sitting reading your book as anyone would be doing on a bus. Could you share that story with us and explain why you feel it was important to discuss it?
Yeah, so I discussed it originally in relation to the book. So it was so when I was a few years ago, and I was coming back from Belfast. It was late at night. I'd been to see a play, and I was on the bus about halfway back to Dublin, and I was really engrossed. Can't remember what I was reading, but I was engrossed in the book. And the bus was almost empty, and I had my feet up, no shoes on, just to make that clear, on the seat beside me, and I was wearing a short dress, and I guess, or wasn't that short, but I guess it had come up a bit on my thighs. Anyway, I saw this light in front of me, just like something that caught a reflective surface, and I got a fright, and I kicked my legs in the air as a reflex, and a phone fell from between the two seats in front of me on the bus. And so I realised that the man in front of me on the bus had been filming my legs and up my skirt for, I don't know, a chunk of the bus journey. And I had actually heard him on the phone earlier, so I didn't know his name, but I knew where he worked and where he was staying that night because he was booking a hotel and telling them what company he worked for and getting a deal. But anyway, I kicked my legs up and I saw the phone and I looked down and I could see the recorder was on, you know, and that it had been recording and I don't know for how long. And I got such a fright. And the thing that made me discuss this and made me write a better version of it is when these sort of, I call them minor sexual assaults. I mean, like, it's not, you know, the more grave end, obviously, and I wouldn't want to write about that because be comfortable.
These
minor ones still have an effect, and I think I describe them sometimes as commonplace. There are things like that happen to women, and they accept to an extent because if you dwelled on them, you'd drive yourself mad. And in that instance, if I was my friend, you know, advising, I would say, well, what you should have done is gotten up and screamed at him, then gone up to the driver, kicked up and got almighty stink, got him thrown off the bus, which is what you should do. Everyone should do. I should have done. But I didn't. I got a fright. I took all my stuff. I moved to the back of the bus. I sat there shaking until the next stop, which was Dublin Airport, where I got off, which was not where I meant to be. And it was like 1:30 at night. Just needed to get off. It was fight or flight. And that was years ago now, maybe 6 years ago. And there's been lots of little things like that that, you know, happened, that every woman has those stories.
Can I park for just a moment on that? Mm. Because you're probably recounting something that is happening to a lot of women, particularly listening in this morning. And your analysis of it is intriguing because you're at one point saying, if I was my friend, there would have been a stand-up row, he'd been booted off the bus and you really would have tackled it.
Yeah.
But when you stop being your friend in this putative sense and actually you're yourself, you can't legislate or plan for the disgust and the trauma, is too strong a word, but just the unpleasantness of it all. And you react totally differently to the person you thought you might have been.
It's the way you are. And like, I am not meek, you know, and I would stand up for myself often. But in those cases, I guess it's a protective thing, and you instantly protect yourself and you do whatever that needs to be done. And
when did you realise that incident was utterly inappropriate and awful?
I I remember a couple of, like, I don't know when it was, maybe a year after it happened, I was telling the story in a pub, like a fun story, this funny thing that happened. Then I realised, well, I wasn't laughing and no one else I was telling was laughing, and it wasn't fun. It was a terrible thing and it shouldn't have happened, and I should have done something about it. And it was, it wasn't actually when the incident happened, it was when I was recounting it and I realised that the effect was still there, that I decided it was something worth writing about. And I haven't written about that specific incident in Three Little Truths, but what I have is this family that move in, Martha and her family. They've been through a sort of what I might call a minor sexual assault as a family, and you see how that affects them. Nobody did what they thought they would have done at the time.
Yes.
And then they're angry about this and they want justice, and then it manifests itself in all these different ways as it goes along. And I would say that, like, you know, in the book, it's only a small section of the book, much like in real life, it's only a small section. Like, that doesn't, I don't think about that very often, that incident, you know, because you just get on with things.
Yeah, but we call them micro incidents, or somebody does anyway. But actually they can feel much more macro in your head. Or
whatever. They fester. Yeah.
They fester. And, you know, you could probably list off a number of incidents where you go, yeah, somebody kind of did that and somebody else did that. And there's an acceptability to these things if you don't discuss them necessarily. And, you know, particularly for men, need to hear about how inappropriate it is. Therefore, we learn. I'm not trying to be
absolutely. And I, like, I'm writing that out. Like in the book, the character that undergoes the brunt of this minor sexual assault is a teenager. And the adults in the book often are telling her not to be so dramatic about, you know, her reaction to it. But actually, I'm on the teenager side, you know, really. And if she needs to be dramatic, let her be dramatic, you know.
Tell me about the rape list story that was from the national headlines.
Yes. So that was... it was a story in Cork, I think it was a year ago, or maybe just over a year ago. There was a school, it was a secondary school in Cork, and a list had been on the back of a toilet door with, it said, I don't even like saying this out loud, but it said, the girl with the most ticks will be raped. And there was a list of girls' names. And someone, I think someone phoned a local radio station in Cork, and maybe their kid was in school or they'd heard about this. And then that's how it became a story. And so that I almost verbatim taken that and put it in the book. So that happens in the local secondary school. And that's one of the kind of scandals that the neighbours are dealing with, because the principal lives on the road and some of the affected girls, their parents live on the road. So that, like, there's the fallout of that. But I, like, actually, when I was writing it, I knew there was something real life in it. It was only after I finished the book that I went and looked up, and I realised that I had remembered it verbatim, the wording of what had been written on the back of the door. Yeah. Like, sometimes you do hear those things. They're passing news stories. I'd say that was only a story for a day or two.
Creepy, but horrible story.
Like, and you think, who writes that? But more you think, if you're like, that's another minor sexual assault. If you're a girl on that list, no one's touched you, no one's done anything. But it's awful to think that someone put your name on something like that.
But again, healthy to talk about it and to highlight it. There's in Three Little Truths, Edie is desperate to start a family, as you know. And I just think that this idea of the friends saying, you know, you can have fun trying.
If
you're having trouble, yeah, but you can have the fun getting there. And this kind of expression or advice kind of made you groan.
Now, in the book, Edie she's one of the new neighbours, and she has a seemingly perfect life, except she doesn't have a child. And her husband, who had agreed to have children, has suddenly gone off the idea. And so she's struggling with this. I mean, she can't have a kid on her own, obviously, and much to her dismay. And so she's putting on a front of saying, yeah, we're trying for a family and blah, blah, but actually there's no physical trying happening behind the scenes. And we were getting pregnant, thinking about getting pregnant at the time that I was writing the book. Now, thankfully, I had a very willing partner in that. But I just remember talking to people about it, and people say things vaguely, like, I don't even think about it. Like, you can have fun trying. And I was like, there's nothing fun about it. I mean, the act of sex before you're trying to get pregnant is one thing, and then when you're trying to get pregnant, it's entirely different. I mean, you're like, sometimes for now, I didn't have, like, it was relatively easy for me, thankfully, but I have friends who've, you know, they're on the strictest of schedules for months. I mean, there's
got to get home.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Got to go. No, sorry, no watching TV. We have to do this now. I mean, there's no fun in trying for that, you know? And so I just wanted to represent that. Someone that to the to the public facing says, yeah, everything's great, but behind they have all the stress of trying to get pregnant.
You know, sometimes you talk to an author, Ethna, and you say, so how much of you is in this book? And they say, oh, nothing, don't, please, I hate that question. You're all over this.
Yeah, but in little ways.
I know, I don't get
you
that.
Know, and yeah. So, and like, even, you know, stuff like that. Like my mum, who was not, like we have talked to her, was not so delighted when I told her it was based on a version of The Road. I gave her an early copy, so she just finished it a couple of days ago. Good. And she's away, but she texted me and she said that she loved it and everything. And I know that she genuinely did. And I think partly because she realises she cannot actually represent, you can't recognise any neighbours because they're not actually in the book, and so she's not going to be kicked out of her house. So, yeah,
so that's all good. Well yeah. done, Ethna, says the text, for bringing all of this up. The same happened to me on a Dublin bus 15 years ago. A man masturbated under his jacket beside me. I was in the window seat. Had to stand up, pass him. He eyeballed me. I had to get off the bus also, not at my stop. It was late for a night out. I didn't say it to the bus driver either. Fight or flight, like you say. And it became a joke later on that night out with my friends. You know, people sometimes so uncomfortable.
Oh, I'm
with
so sorry. With the grisly truth. Yeah, I'm really sorry that happened to that person. Those things, sometimes we write them off and you need people to not write them off.
I think we could probably fill a show with these stories, to be quite honest with you. Ethna, congratulations on all your success. I know that Three Little Truths is a part of the BBC Radio 2 book club, which is
amazing to me.
It's a big deal. And it is amazing, but it's tremendous. But you earned it. You know, they didn't do it for the good of your health. So that's great. Congratulations on Ruan, who is an absolute joy and a pleasure to hold this morning. Thank you for letting me. Thank you for sharing. And good luck with it all. Congratulations on the new book. So it's all going on.
Yes.
Mind
great.
Yourself, Ethna Shortall. Thank you. Thanks for coming to see us as always. The time now is 9:45. That's it for this week. Hope you enjoy it. Until next time, thanks for listening.